Welcome to a brand new deep dive. Today we are opening up the Holland Codex.
We are indeed.
And we're looking at a stack of session logs to recap the beginning of a brand new mini campaign.
Right, which is much needed. Because if you have been following the party's exploits,
yeah,
you know they just survived a massive extinction-level confrontation.
Yeah, a really big deal. But we are setting that aside today.
Completely. Our focus is entirely on what happens when they step back onto the gritty, cobblestone streets of the city of Holland.
And we should clarify our mission for this deep dive right up front.
Absolutely. The goal here isn't to oversell the drama or, you know, aggrandize the narrative.
We don't need to do that.
Right. We just want to cut through the noise. We're going to lay out exactly what happened, who the players met, and what hooks are currently dangling in front of them.
It's really about giving you, the listener, a clear map of the board.
Exactly. So you can actually understand all the moving parts in this incredibly complex city.
Okay, let's unpack this, because this new arc kicks off the literal morning after the last one ended.
No rest for the weary.
None at all. The party just stopped a massive fairy ritual at the Cathedral of Gratzka. You'd expect a hero's parade or some sort of grand municipal recognition.
Oh, surely.
But instead, they immediately get hit with citywide political bureaucracy and magical intrigue.
That tonal shift is brilliant, really, because Holland is a city that simply does not care about your heroics.
Not one bit.
It only cares about its own internal mechanisms.
Mm.
So they transition straight from fighting a world-ending threat into a grounded corporate meeting at the company boardroom.
Right. They are summoned by Jorvik and Leona Volstead.
Yeah. And suddenly they are sitting across from a cast of highly influential municipal figures. You have Anya.
The keeper of the lion's mouth.
Yes, which is essentially the secret police's anonymous tipping system.
And she also happens to have past ties to Elgis's estranged father, Garth.
Right, adding a fun personal complication there.
Always.
Then you have Captain Burns of the Admiralty and a rather severe man named Helmholtz.
And in this boardroom, the party isn't handed some mythical quest to slay a dragon.
No, they get municipal paperwork.
Exactly. They are handed three very grounded immediate problems. First, there has been some sort of unspecified mishap at the Admiralty brig down in the shipyards.
Vague, but ominous.
Very. Second, an Admiralty prosthetist named Vorman.
A man who makes artificial limbs for injured sailors.
Right. He has vanished without a trace. And third, Helmholtz drops a deeply alarming piece of information regarding the city's Masters of Revels.
Right, because the players already knew that the current Master of Revels, a man named Livingston, met a gruesome end.
Eaten by harpies at the Eyrie.
Yeah, nasty way to go. But Helmholtz reveals a pattern. The previous Master of Revels, Kent, is missing.
Wow.
And the Master of Revels before him, Ella, is also completely unaccounted for.
So someone, or some faction, is systematically removing the city's Masters of Revels from the board.
That is the working theory.
So the party leaves the boardroom with these three very tangible mysteries. But as they step out of the building, here's where it gets really interesting.
Oh, this encounter is fantastic.
They are immediately confronted by seven strange women.
Dressed in Victorian clothing.
Yeah, with buttons going all the way down the front of their dresses.
And the game master uses these seven women entirely as a Greek chorus.
They don't draw weapons or roll for initiative or anything.
No, instead, they directly confront the players about their past moral choices.
Holding up a mirror to the character's actions.
Exactly. Specifically targeting those moments where the players prioritize convenience over ethics.
Like Kiltak's brutal execution of captive enemies.
Right. They point out that he killed a harpy and a cultist long after they had surrendered or answered his question.
Brutal. They also call out Elgis's stated desire to usurp his father's fortune and boot him out of his estate.
And they expose Hayden, questioning his dangerous, duplicitous game of playing double agent against his otherworldly patron, Aurora.
Which is a risky game.
Very. And then they heavily criticize the entire party's decision to hand the incredibly dangerous pendant stone right back to Merrick.
The very man whose incompetence lost it in the first place.
It is wild they did that.
The surreal nature of this encounter really stands out, especially when they zero in on Virgil.
Oh, the Dante comparison.
Yes. They compare him directly to Dante's guide through the Inferno, the Roman poet Virgil, who represents human reason over faith.
They note his profound cynicism and skepticism toward the gods.
And then, in a very strange, almost mocking gesture, they gift him a magical item called the Ring of Abject Success.
Such a funny item.
Mechanically, if you roll a one on a critical check, The ring activates and turns that failure into the lowest possible number required to succeed.
This raises an important question for you as the listener to consider regarding how these games are often played.
How so?
Well, how frequently do players just bulldoze through moral gray areas for a tactical advantage?
Ah, the classic murder hobo tendencies.
Exactly. Treating the world like a video game to be looted rather than a lived-in space with consequences.
Right.
This chorus forces the characters to actually reckon with the visible stain their brutality and ambition leaves on the world.
It's the city of Holland pushing back.
Yes, demanding they acknowledge the weight of their actions.
And that moral reckoning sets a heavy tone for the rest of the recap. Because immediately following this encounter, the party decides to hunt down a lich named Ischold,
who is supposedly hiding under the abandoned Gramercy books in the Braddock District.
Right. They navigate the ruins of this bookstore and discover a secret door behind a bookshelf.
But the lock on this door completely bypasses character skill sheets.
It is a brutal 50-50 puzzle door.
It is a horrifying piece of physical design that forces raw player agency.
The door has no knob, just two fist-sized holes and a heavy lever.
Right. You have to put your arm into one of the holes and turn a handle, which locks your arm entirely in place.
And if you pick the correct hole, pulling the lever opens the door and releases you.
But if you pick the wrong hole,
the mechanism instantly shatters your arm into 100 unrecognizable pieces.
Just a horrific consequence. And as the players are explicitly told, no amount of magical locksmithing or thievery skill can help you here.
It is a pure, blind 50-50 chance.
The psychological pressure of a trap like that at the table is immense.
Elgis actually steps up, volunteers to take the 50-50 chance, and mercifully, he succeeds.
A huge sigh of relief there.
The mechanism clicks, the door opens, and they descend a massive 10-story pit lined with decaying bookshelves.
Finally hitting a dirt floor that just reeks of old paper.
And the scene at the bottom completely subverts the standard fantasy tropes.
Oh, totally. An 18th level lich in this world is an entity wielding near godlike arcane power.
You expect a skeletal monstrosity sitting on a throne of bones.
Radiating necrotic energy.
Exactly. Instead, they find Ischold lounging comfortably on a daybed, surrounded by an opium kit.
He is an undead scholar lost in a drug-induced malaise.
Which, unfortunately, does not deter Kiltak from attempting a completely suicidal sneak attack against him.
Classic Kiltak.
The sheer panic at the table during that moment must have been palpable. Barnaby the cleric tries to magically command Kiltak to stop, but Kiltak resists the spell.
It actually comes down to Virgil.
Yes. Virgil has to physically trip his own teammate to the ground to stop him from attacking the lich.
And all that commotion wakes Ischold up. But rather than annihilating the party,
which he easily could have.
Easily. Ischold simply reads Hayden's mind. He sees Hayden's desperate search for power and very casually offers him a job.
The demand Ischold makes is terrifying, precisely because of its clinical absurdity.
Ischold is obsessed with logic puzzles. He tells Hayden about the two guards' riddle.
The classic hypothetical puzzle where one guard always lies, one always tells the truth.
Right. And you must ask one question to find the door to freedom.
But Ischold explains that theoretical logic alone is insufficient.
He wants to empirically solve these paradoxes in the real world.
Which leads the party into one of the darkest, most unsettling scenes in these logs.
It really is.
Ischold has a man in a cage nearby named Modali Grellin, a man who happens to be a compulsive liar.
And Ischold is currently trying to study the liar's paradox.
The philosophical statement, this sentence is a lie.
Exactly. But he's studying it by inflicting raw physical pain.
He violently beats the cage with a cruel steel rod, screaming over and over, is the sentence a lie?
He is literally trying to force a mathematical truth out of this liar through sheer horror.
We have all been frustrated by a difficult riddle, but Ischel's response represents the ultimate extreme of academic obsession divorced from morality.
It perfectly encapsulates the logic of a lich. He views extreme human suffering as just another variable in a mathematical proof.
And so he lays out his exact demands to Hayden.
To complete his physical experiment for the two guards' riddle, Ischold needs an honest man, two doors, and a hungry lion.
An honest man, two doors, and a lion. It is such a bizarre, surreal shopping list.
And if Hayden brings him those specific components, Ischold will hand over the kidnapped fairy Laurel and grant Hayden immense power.
It beautifully illustrates the dark tone of Holland.
This high-level undead threat isn't dangerous because he wants to conquer the continent.
No.
He is dangerous because of his twisted mathematical curiosity.
And it provides such a stark contrast to what happens right after the party leaves the bookstore.
Oh, with Virgil.
Yes. Virgil, the character of the Greek chorus just called out for his profound cynicism, quietly goes to Chambers the apothecary.
And anonymously donates 500 gold pieces to the local orphanage.
That quiet moment of charity from the party's rogue really grounds the characters against the backdrop of an undead scholar torturing a man over syntax.
It adds so much dimension to him.
But the surface streets of Holland do not stay quiet for long.
They never do.
The party splits up to handle different tasks, and Elgis ends up at the Mooncalf Tavern, where he is approached by a woman named Brandy Cranston.
And Brandy proposes a prison break,
which immediately pulls the party into a dense web of faction politics.
Let's untangle those politics for you, because they are vital to understanding the city's power structures.
Okay, laid out.
Brandy is nominally a member of the Hobnail Gang, but Elgis knows she is actually a spy who infiltrated the gang for the secret police.
Right.
She tells Elgis that her Uncle Carter is currently locked up in the secret police's Hobnail prison.
Her own faction's prison.
Yes. According to Brandy, her uncle and the chief of the secret police, Durer, were involved in a business scheme together.
And things went sour.
Very sour. Now she wants Elgis to help her break her uncle out of a prison run by the very man he was doing business with.
And the nature of that business scheme is the crucial detail. It is called a tontine.
Right.
For those unfamiliar, a tontine is an archaic financial instrument, an investment pool where a group of people put in money and they receive dividends.
But the catch is what happens when someone dies.
Exactly. Right. When a member of the tontine dies, their shares do not pass on to their family or estate.
Instead, those shares are split among the surviving members of the pool.
By its very nature, a tontine is inherently prone to murder.
It is essentially a legally binding financial death pool. The fewer people left alive, the richer the remaining survivors become.
And to add a final chaotic layer to this heist, Brandy reveals that her boss in the gang, a woman named Ulrich, who serves as the second in command, is going with her into the prison.
The players immediately put the pieces together here.
Because the leader of the Hobnail gang currently runs his empire from inside that prison.
Yes. Ulrich is not going in to rescue Uncle Carter.
She is using the rescue operation as a smokescreen to assassinate her boss and take over the gang.
Knowing all of this, knowing they are walking into a messy crossfire between a gang coup and a corrupt secret police chief, the party decides to jump right in and help with the prison break.
Of course they do.
Naturally.
While half the party is getting tangled up in the bloody economics of a tontine, Hayden is dealing with a totally different kind of threat.
He heads down into the opium dens beneath the Mooncalf to speak with Kaskar, a rogue trader.
Right, he wants to learn more about the fairies they encountered at the cathedral.
What's fascinating here is the sheer amount of foundational lore Kaskar drops, completely shifting how the party needs to view the Fae moving forward.
Kaskar explains that fairies are not traditional combatants.
No, they do not engage in honorable warfare or line up on a battlefield.
They rely entirely on subterfuge and misdirection.
He reveals that they can actually physically hide inside your own shadow and strike from within it.
The tactical implications of that for the players are terrifying. You are never safe if your own shadow can produce a blade.
It turns every dimly lit room into a potential ambush.
And Kaskar also notes their strange psychological quirks.
Like their fascination with human gear.
Specifically, the gear used for work animals, like horse bridles.
Even though fairies have absolutely no practical use for them.
He mentions they are drawn to a great abandoned human city called Balabana, located far from Holland.
But the most critical takeaway is Kaskar's warning regarding their motivation.
What do they actually want?
Exactly. The fairies view this entire region as their ancestral domain, and they want it back.
They are not merely strange creatures lurking in the woods.
They are an encroaching, highly organized threat intent on reclamation.
So with that heavy existential lore drop hanging over them, the party regroups for dinner in the Mooncalf courtyard.
They are meeting up with Burgess Lorentz, who is the watch captain, and Elgis's old martial master, Titarian.
They are supposed to be having a quiet evening celebrating a new portrait of the watch.
But before they even order, a prominent businessman named Giles Ulm rushes into the courtyard.
He is frantic, and he tells Burgess that he just got home and found his wife, Selma, dead.
And Burgess immediately notes the pattern, mentioning that another prominent citizen, Tamir Rabi, was also found dead just the day before.
The tension in the courtyard spikes instantly as the watch captain realizes these are not isolated incidents.
And before anyone can even process the murder of Selma Ulm, A mystery woman walks into the courtyard.
She scans the room, locks eyes on Burgess Lorenz, asks him to confirm his name.
And the moment he does, she pulls a blunderbuss out of her cloak and opens fire at point-blank range.
Total chaos erupts in the middle of dinner.
Let's examine this ambush closely, because her arsenal is highly specific and deeply concerning.
Oh, yeah. After firing the blunderbuss, she draws a specialized weapon called a bat's head rapier.
The pommel is literally shaped like a carved bat.
And mechanically, when the blade strikes a target, it forces a wisdom save.
This means the sheer terror of the weapon attacks the victim's mind, not just their body.
Inflicting additional psychic damage by forcing them to experience a waking nightmare.
Just a horrific weapon to face. And to further complicate the battlefield, she summons massive swarms of Luna Moths to obscure vision and aid her in the fight.
The party scrambles to fight back, and Elgis actually manages to land a massive critical hit on her in the fourth round.
But instead of dying from the blow, the woman literally dissipates into a moon shadow and slips away.
She escapes the courtyard, leaving her blunderbuss and that terrifying bat's head rapier clattering on the cobblestones.
Naturally, Virgil immediately claims the rapier for himself.
Of course he does.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this ambush clearly wasn't a random tavern brawl or a simple mugging.
No, this was a highly coordinated assassination attempt by an operative utilizing shadow magic and psychic weaponry.
And it perfectly synthesizes where the party stands at the end of these session logs.
They are completely surrounded by different intersecting threads of conspiracy.
Right after the fight, Virgil manages to track down a contact named Velvet to ask her about those missing Masters of Revels we mentioned back at the boardroom.
And Velvet gives him a crucial piece of the puzzle.
All three of the missing masters, Livingston, Kent, and Ella, were heavily involved in exclusive Thursday night salons hosted by Ms. Miller.
The owner of the Mooncalf.
Yes. This solidifies the party's immediate game plan.
It's currently Wednesday in the game world. They resolve to infiltrate Miss Miller's salon on Thursday night to investigate exactly what is happening to the Masters of Revels.
And following that, they are going to execute the Hobnail prison break alongside Brandy and Ulrich.
Busy schedule. So what does this all mean? When you step back and look at these two session logs, you see a party that has entirely shifted gears.
They really have.
They have moved away from a relatively straightforward rescue mission in a ruined cathedral, right into a tangled web of philosophical leches, secret police tontines, and shadow assassins.
The beauty of this campaign is its grounded complexity. It is not a story about pristine heroes saving the world from a singular dark lord.
Not at all.
The players are navigating a gritty, breathing city where absolutely every NPC has an angle.
You have the Blackwell Embassy reluctantly buying back their own stolen green cake from privateers.
You have a spy using a prison break to facilitate a gangland assassination.
And you have an 18th level lich who doesn't want your soul. He just needs an honest man for a math riddle.
Exactly. It forces the players to think critically about who they trust and what the secondary effects of their actions will be in a city that never stops moving.
It is a phenomenal example of intricate world building.
Yep.
Thank you for taking this deep dive into the Holland Codex with us. Seeing the board laid out like this makes the political and magical stakes of this new arc so much clearer for the players.
And I want to leave you with a final provocative thought to mull over, building on the sources we've discussed today.
Oh, please do.
Consider Brandy Cranston's mention of the Tontine.
That grim investment pool that pays out more money to the survivors as its members die.
Right. We know the chief of the secret police is involved in one. Now look at the events of the last few days in Holland.
Okay.
Selma Ulm is suddenly found dead. Kamir Rabi is found dead. The last three Masters of Revels are either missing or eaten by harpies.
Right.
Could it be that half of the mysterious deaths and disappearances in the city of Holland aren't random monster attacks or isolated assassinations, but are actually the grim execution of a citywide financial death pool? If that is true, who else might be on that subscriber list?